Hello, and welcome to That's Not Spit, It's Condensation.
Hello, and welcome to That's Not Spit, It's Condensation. I'm Ryan Beach, and today's episode is one that I've wanted to do for a very long time. I'm here with one of my best friends, Dan Carson, who is a newly tenured member of the bass section with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. It's incredible. I've known Dan for a long time. We actually played together in Alabama 8 or 9 years ago. I can't remember how long ago at this point. And we became fast friends during our time here. And then I kind of want to take this episode to tell the story of how Dan got from Alabama to Chicago, because I think it's a really interesting story. And I think it's one that hopefully you listening will be able to identify with and be able just to see some risk taking that has paid off in a cool way. So first of all, before we dive into the story, I want to say thank you, Dan, for giving me some of your time and just so we could chat and tell the story.
Dude, it's my pleasure, man. I love your podcast and I'm just really excited to connect and chat again.
Yeah. So the way we'll start this is Dan and I lived together for a year. We practiced together. We wrote music together. We maybe partied together a couple of times. Yeah, and towards the end of that year, Dan made the decision to take a year leave of absence to finish his undergrad degree. Because you won, if I'm not correct, you won your job with the ASO as principal bass during your junior year of undergrad, or you had finished your junior year. What's the timeline there?
Yeah, like right after the end of my junior year.
Okay. So then he wanted to take a year leave of absence to finish his senior year. And I kind of just want to pick up the story there. If you don't mind sharing, what prompted you to even think about going back to school and finishing this out, and then kind of just pick up the story from there?
Yeah. Yeah. It's, it looms really large in my life because it was like, it feels like, yeah, Alabama was my first job. Like I started there when I was 21 and, yeah, I guess I got that at the end of my junior year. And I remember talking to some of my teachers before I went down to Alabama and they had said, oh, this will be a stepping stone job and, you'll keep taking auditions and you're at the top of your game. And hopefully you'll get another one. And, I don't know. I was so young, like 21. I hadn't really thought very much about what my career was going to look like or what I would do after college. And so I don't think I really realized much about how challenging it could be to hold down a full-time job while also taking other auditions. And to be totally honest, like Alabama was my first audition. So I really didn't expect to win. I really just kind of, I had a teacher from my high school bass teacher, Andy Anderson, who I love and respect. He told me, you should make sure you take an orchestra audition before the end of your junior year. He just thought that was a good timeline for like getting acquainted with the process. So that's why I took Alabama. I kind of did it for the experience. And then when I won, everybody, like all my mentors were saying, oh, well, orchestra auditions orchestra positions are so scarce and like, you'd be crazy not to take that job and it'll change your life and all these things. And, but also teachers were telling me, but this definitely won't be the end of the road for you. And like, you should be like, you'll probably win another audition in a year or two. And so that's kind of like the mindset I had going in. And then I remember actually my first or second year in Alabama, I took Detroit after it was my first audition after starting there and I didn't advance. And I And then I took Seattle and I did an advance. And I took Atlanta and I think I did an advance. And so I kind of had this experience of like, it's just so challenging to like, once you're settled in like a really secure position, to like stay sharp and stay competitive. And like, I remember I had a lot of friends who were still in school who had started auditioning for master's degrees at Juilliard or Rice or USC. And I don't know, after a while, I just kind of had this sense of like, I'm having a harder time kind of like getting better and pushing myself than I expected. Which I don't know if you have felt that way being in Alabama too, but like, for me, it's kind of like, there's not a ton of, I mean, Alabama is a great orchestra and in Birmingham, you know, there's like the ballet and, we do operas and there's like stuff going on at Samford and UAB. So there are like musical outlets there, but as far as like kind of, it feels like a little bit like an island a little bit. And so I don't know, I sort of felt, like it was hard for me to keep pushing myself. And so I felt like I had this good excuse to leave, to take a year off and go back to school. And like Kevin, like you remember Kevin Kozak? I don't know. Sure. Is Kevin still there?
Yeah, he's still here.
I remember talking to him about it and he said, oh, Dan, like a bachelor's degree is really important. And like, you should definitely go back. I just remember having that conversation with him and having some older members of the orchestra encourage me to finish school. And that really meant a lot to me. I felt like really supported by some of the veteran members of the orchestra that I really looked up to. So yeah, I don't know. I just kind of thought about it and I thought like, I would really regret if I didn't have a bachelor's, like if later on in life, I could see myself being like, it really sucks that I don't have a college degree. So I that was pretty much a no brainer. The tougher decision was deciding to resign and get my master's, which we can talk about that too.
Yeah. Before we get there, I think it would be cool to sort of talk about going back to school after having a job and what was that experience like? Because my memories of living with you were still very much like a student. You know what I mean? Like clearly you're a professional, you're doing the job, you're sounding great. But I also feel like part of you was still a student. You still like loved listening and studying and learning things and all that kind of stuff. So to have won the job, to have seen what that's like, and then to be back in an educational environment, I'm curious for you to talk a little bit about what that's like. And then I remember vividly hearing your senior recital, like some recording of your senior recital at IU.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember sending you a message or calling you or something. And I've always supported you. I feel like I've always supported you. But I remember when I heard you and I had heard the progress you had made, I was like, you did the right thing. Like, this is clearly like the reasons that you did this. I tried to be as supportive as I could in that moment to say, like, we have no idea what's going to happen, but the amount of improvement that you've made, like out, like not on an island, but in an institution designed for that, was pretty remarkable, I thought. And so I kind of just want you to talk about that year at IU, what it was like, what the differences were and stuff like that.
Yeah, man, I remember that phone call and you've always, it's been really fun checking in with you over the years. Cause like, I remember right after I left, like it felt kind of risky. Like it felt like some of my colleagues were probably like, what is Dan thinking? Why did he do that? And so I don't know. It's one of those things where you just have to own your own decision, but it was really nice to, I remember you calling me and that meant a lot to me. Going back to school, like, kind of going back for a second round is sort of like what it was. Cause I had already been there for 3 years and then I had worked for 3 years, which you're right. I think there's a little bit of a culture of, like you've already made it. And so like nobody, it's sort of like, it's a little bit egotistical, but it's like people don't necessarily expect you to keep learning. But in my opinion, that's like always the way to live your life, like with a desire to grow. But when you're in school, it's like, it just gave me a new appreciation for like being around people and just having this opportunity where the explicit purpose is to learn and grow. And, I think, I don't know if you had this experience in going to college, but for me, like when I first went, when I was 18, I kind of went just because like, that's what you do at that age. Like if you have a certain like amount of financial resources and a certain like trajectory in life, school, like college is just what you do after high school. And so it wasn't this thing that I think I just took it for granted. But when I went back the second time, I didn't take it for granted at all. Like every day was like, I really left something important behind that a lot of other people wouldn't have left because I'm pursuing something that I think is more important, you know, to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so like, I remember I would go into lessons with just lists of questions, like just in my notebook, like if I move my finger on the bow in this position, like how does that change my spiccato? And like, when do I, like when I'm shifting and changing fingers, like when do I change the new finger during the shift? And like all these really detailed technical questions. I guess to be honest, that was more in my master's. If I'm being totally honest, like going back to IU at first, it was really humbling. Like, I think I kind of thought that I was like hot shit when I left Alabama. I was kind of like, oh, I've already had a job. And then I went back and kind of realized all these people were like getting ready for master's auditions and like, just really pushing themselves in a way that I had not actually pushed myself. I think I just got a little complacent being
employed. It's easy to do. It's certainly easy to do. Cause when you're auditioning, you're trying to refine like all of these excerpts from the entirety of the repertoire. Or if you have solos for juries or recitals and things, it's like really pushing you. But I mean, for strings, it's obviously different. A lot of the orchestral repertoire is unbelievably challenging, but the challenges like for the trumpet are so different than so many other types of repertoire that it's just easy to get to a place where you're like, I understand how to do my job and to do it at a high level. And then to get better from there is, it's like a lot of work, as you know, and you don't know sometimes if it's making a difference in like your actual ability to do the job. You don't see the same kind of, in my opinion, the same kind of, how do I say this? Like return on investment as you do, like when you're working up an audition list and for whatever reason, it feels like you can see the progress more easily. So I'm kind of with you and you know that I've developed my own ways of thinking about things so that I can continue to get better.
Yeah. That's interesting about like progress on the job versus progress preparing for auditions. I just think they're different. It's not that one is more important or less important. I think they're just different skill sets for different situations. But like, I think in the orchestra, sometimes you're just, when you're one of eight bass players, you can just get away with more stuff. Like as much as we all strive to be perfect, like in the orchestra, if one note doesn't speak perfectly or your stroke is like not perfectly even, like you can kind of get away with that. But in auditions, like you're giving a recital, you know?
Yeah.
And so I just remember like playing a lot of going back to school was just about discipline for me. Like in the orchestra, it was kind of about like really going for it and expressing myself. And I remember I had a lesson with David Moore at USC, and like it was kind of my first lesson where I remembered I played pretty well and he was like, what have you been doing? Like, what happened? Like, this is the best I've ever heard you play. Like it's very disciplined. It's very in tune. It's like the tempo's great. It's just consistent. Like, what have you been doing? And I think we kind of talked about that and he said like, when you first got here, you were kind of like a wild player. Like you had a lot of spirit and a lot of energy and like emotional commitment, but notes wouldn't speak and it would be out of tune and tempo would be kind of all over the place. And so it was, he was like, I could kind of see that you had it in you, but you needed to be disciplined. So like that was a big part of, that was like most of my work going back to school, was just like preparing for auditions just takes so much discipline. And you kind of have to like, before you can be, at least, I don't know, this is the way I think about it. Like the, before you can let it all hang out and be really expressive, like first you have to rein everything in and just be like, you have to figure out how to color inside the lines, you know?
Yeah. That's interesting. So you're at IU, you're making a lot of progress. And you're coming up to the end of this period of time where you got to make a choice, go back to the job or resign. You had already mentioned you resigned. I don't actually know this part of the story. So this is exciting for me. What made you resign? Like what was the thing that convinced you that you should continue pursuing your education?
Yeah. To be honest, I think when I left Alabama, I think I kind of knew that I didn't want to come back. It was just kind of a scary decision to make, but like, it was one of those things where like, when your heart is kind of telling you something, like you can't just ignore it. And like, I don't know. I was like, I think I had until like January or February to tell Alabama whether or not I was going to come back. And, I think that was something like that. And it was just at the point where it was like, okay, if you're going to get a master's degree, you got to start preparing for master's auditions now. And if you're not, then you need to inform Alabama that you're returning now. And so it got to a point where it was kind of just now or never. It was like, I'm either going to go back to this place where I felt like I knew what my life would be like. Like I knew that I just had a feeling I would probably stay there. It would be really hard to win another audition. I knew what I would be going back to. Whereas like, it was kind of like one direction was like, I knew where I would be going and I knew I wouldn't really be happy. The other direction was like, I don't exactly know what's in front of me, but I know that it would probably make me happier than going back there. So it was more like, I don't know. Sometimes I think about life as like, it's not like eye on the prize. Like you see exactly where you're going. You're just making moves in a direction that feels right. And so I didn't know if I was gonna wind up with a better job or maybe changing careers. Like even at that time, I think I was thinking, well, like if I take auditions for couple of years and it doesn't work out, like maybe I'll like go back to business school or like maybe become a history teacher or like these other things that also make me happy. But I just knew that like Alabama was not where I had ever seen myself staying. And I just couldn't see myself being happy there, you know?
Yeah. I do understand.
not at all that's the case for anybody else. It was like a personal decision.
Yeah. And it's cool to hear. Cause I just think lots of people could be in similar situations where you could go to the thing that you know, that you're like, well, this isn't exactly what I want, but I know it, or I'm going to take a bet on myself that I will do the work necessary and I will do the work that is necessary for long enough to get to another place that I want to go. And I'll just like believe that this is possible or at least moving in that direction. So you went to USC, correct?
Right.
And can you just talk about your time at USC, kind of either things that you felt like you learned, you already spoke to it a little bit, but maybe a little bit more in depth about the value of that part of your education and why you're glad you did it.
Yeah. Well, I feel like before I talk about that, I just wanted to say one more thing about like, the decision to kind of take a leap of faith, if that's like a way to put it. And a big part of it is that I had the support of my family. You know, like I, like when I think back on that time, it was really my mom who like encouraged me to go back to school and encouraged me to apply for master's programs. And like, I remember, like, I didn't, if you're picturing it as like somebody with like tremendous confidence and just like, just going courageously into the future, that's not what it felt like. It was basically like, I really don't know what's going to happen. I have a strong gut feeling that this is not where I'm supposed to be. And so I really want to do this, but I'm really scared. And my parents were the ones that were like, especially my mom was kind of like, I know you don't see it now, but like, you got to go with your gut and someday you'll be happy you did this. So I think that's the thing. I just have to like acknowledge my parents and just like, as a general statement about like having a support system, like you never do it completely on your own, you know?
Sure.
But, yeah, so USC was like, I remember I had actually emailed David Moore, the bass teacher at USC, and he's in the LA Philharmonic. I had emailed him when I was in Alabama and I said, hey, like if I, like I have this job, and I had gone to take a lesson with him and I had said, like, I have this job, and if I were to leave and audition and get into your program, like, could I study with you? And we had like a frank conversation about it. And he just said like, yeah, it's a competitive audition, but if you got in, like, I would be very excited to help you like achieve your goals. So that was really encouraging. Not that it was any kind of preferential treatment. Like it really wasn't. It was just kind of like, it was kind of just like having a frank conversation with somebody about like, I can't do these things musically and I want to be able to, and like, can you help me? And he was, I think he was just excited about like a self-motivated student.
It's the dream student, you know?
I don't know, in a way, like, and, so after I got in, that I told you about like feeling kind of undisciplined and a little bit like a wild player. And he was, a lot of it was just working on kind of disciplining my playing. And, but actually like my first year there, like I got there in the fall of 2017 and had like a semester of kind of figuring out this person, this teacher who's like the most technical, just analytical, just at the time, absolutely. Like it was just a completely new level of depth about bass playing and music. Like I didn't know existed, and it was so incredibly amazing. It was just kind of like answers to all these things that I had been wondering about. Like, you remember when I was in Alabama and I would just sit there playing my open A string repeatedly over and over and over again for like,
there's no way I could ever forget that.
As much as I like probably drove people crazy, like it was just like figuring out how to have like a resonant bow changes at the frog, like at a fast tempo, like just playing kind of a resonant, like articulate bow stroke. And like, that is something that I like achieved like working on with David. So it was kind of like, I was in Alabama, like just kind of groping for things in my playing and couldn't figure it out on my own. And finally I had this person who I felt like had answers to everything. But so after we worked, I got there in the fall of 2017, and then I took the Lyric Opera, Chicago Lyric Opera audition the spring of 2018, and I had won a position there. And that was kind of surprising because it happened like really fast.
Yeah.
And then again, I decided to turn that down, which is like, I don't know. It was one of these things where like I had given up so much to get to LA with this great teacher. And then the thought of going to work for an opera company in Chicago, my hometown, which was exciting, but like, they were on strike at the time. So I kind of got a sense that, it made me nervous, like that the organization was having financial problems, which, you know, no shade on them. It's like everybody struggles with that. But like, and then also just practicing opera for like, or performing opera and rehearsing opera every day. And then if I ever wanted to get a symphony job, I would have to go home after like a double, like playing 5 hours of Wagner or Verdi or something, and then go home and learn a symphony list. Like, I just had a feeling that that would be too hard. So it was another instance of taking a risk, you know, staying in school, being like, I don't know where I want to end up, but I don't think that's it.
And if I remember correctly, when we talked about this event, you had said to me, your heart is just with the symphony orchestra. It's not like, I mean, I know you love listening to opera, but your heart in performing is with a symphony orchestra. And so to know to that degree that that's where your heart is, that you would, that you would turn down a job. Cause I think a lot of people would say, great, I like want a job that pays well, you know, it's like, I think it's like a 26, 28 week season. So you have the other half the year to do, potentially other types of things. Like for a lot of people, that's like the dream, but for you, it just didn't line up with where you ideally saw yourself. But like I said, to know to that degree so that you can say to yourself, I'm going to make this choice. It seems crazy. While other people are probably calling you crazy to your face or behind your back. It's like, I got to respect the move. You know what I mean? I got to respect that, like, you're that true to yourself and like what you want, that like you would just rather somebody else like get that job who is going to like love being in that job.
Yeah. It's like kind of just, again, it's like just a personal decision. And like I remember actually listening to your interview with Demondre Thurman, and like the phrase that he kept using in that interview was like, what moves the needle for you? Mm. Which means like just what is meaningful to you, and or like at musically meaningful and personally meaningful. And I don't know, being in a pit, like having my musical life be in the pit, like being totally subordinated to the singers and what's just, and like what's going on stage, which, not that the music isn't important artistically, but that the music is not central visually to the performance. Like when you're in an orchestra, like you are it. And so there's that. And then, the rep, like I'm just like Beethoven symphonies just doesn't get better than that for me.
Yeah.
And
I can think of a lot of things that are better than Beethoven symphonies for me, but I understand where you're coming from. I mean, obviously the music, I don't love every Beethoven symphony, but I can understand that musically it's like incredible. It's just the trumpet parts are very sometimes not engaging, which is not a reason to not try. It's just funny to me because I feel like I find myself in things like Strauss, or even like Tchaikovsky, Mahler, Shostakovich. I love Shostakovich. I love the colors we get to play with in Shostakovich. You know what I mean? So it's more for like the enjoyment of the performance. I find Beethoven to be not at the top of my list.
Yeah. I mean, that's the same thing for me with like Fauré. Like Fauré is like some of the most beautiful music, and it's some of the most boring to play as a bass player. And like just a lot of like very delicate effects and harmonics and a lot of resting. But for me as a string player, Beethoven symphonies, Brahms symphonies, Brahms never wrote an opera, you know, like all these composers that are the bread and butter of orchestral playing. And I do love opera, but like, it's not what I was trained on. And it's not what I ended up loving. But I mean, like the broader question you're asking about just like being willing to take a risk when like, you know, it's what your heart is telling you, but it's scary. You know, that's, I don't know. It's always a judgment call. And the way my life has kind of ended up is that I've done a couple of pretty risky career. I've made a couple of pretty risky career choices that other people might not have made. And like the fact that I've ended up where I am is like really a blessing. And also, like, even if I weren't in the Chicago Symphony, like I said, if I went back to school and went to like decide to become a history teacher or like work in arts management or something, like I still think that that would be better than staying in Alabama or joining Lyric. I did have a sense of, I mean, the Chicago Symphony has always been my dream job, but it was more about just making a decision that felt right with my gut at the time. It was not about, I'm going to make this decision only because it must be validated by something that happens later on in my path. You know, it was kind of like, I'm doing this because it's what my truth is, you know, right now.
So getting back to the, just want to make sure, this is amazing. I love this conversation, but we were talking about Lyric. One of the things I'm interested in too is when you came back to, when you made the decision not to take the job and you're at USC, what kind of reaction did people give you? Because I feel like for a lot of people who are also on that grind, the idea that one of their, you know, peers would win a job and then turn it down, I bet could elicit a number of reactions. Did you kind of, was there like that kind of thing for you, or were people pretty chill about it?
Nobody ever said anything like, I think David would be okay with me sharing this. My teacher, David Moore at the time, he did not approve, I think at first, of my choice. Like he thought it was like, he didn't see why I shouldn't take the Lyric job and then use my copious time off there to keep working for other things and try to move to a different situation if I wanted. So he didn't understand, or maybe he just disagreed with me, which is fine, you know? But I don't know. I didn't really have a lot of conversations with people about it. The hardest thing for me was just owning the decision I made myself and like, and just saying, trying to tune that out. Like whatever I may be imagining other people are saying or whatever people might actually be saying, like it eventually, it was like after I sent the email to Lyric and said, like, I'm going to decline the position and stay in school. It was just kind of like, well, there's nothing I can do. Like, I just have to keep putting one foot in front of the other. So I don't know. I really don't know what people have said, and I've tried not to think about that because that would just make everything harder.
Sure, of course. No, I think that's a pretty smart way to do it. I mean, that I think is a good thing in life in general, you know, like, we can come up with all these things we think people are saying about us one way or another. And then if you just sit there and dwell on things that you do, you know, you don't know about, or maybe even you do, but it's none of your business. You know, I mean, I think it's a good mental space to be in.
Yeah. I have to say, like, I have to say that, like, there's also been tons of people who have who reached out to like be supportive, like you. Also there were a lot of like my peers, like other students that said, hey, it's really cool. Like, I really admire what you're doing. Like, and so there have been a lot of people that have expressed support too. So that's been cool.
Yeah. So as we come to the end of sort of the education sort of era, I guess your second education era of your life, I kind of want you to speak a little bit to the difference between having the job in Alabama and periodically flying out and taking lessons with people, because I know you were doing that a lot, and then actually being in an educational institution. Because in my mind, I remember thinking, I don't know why you don't just keep flying out and playing with people, you know, like what I it was hard for me to understand the difference. So I'm very curious how you would describe the difference between those two scenarios.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's true. Like I have to say, like, one of my new colleagues in the Chicago Symphony, Alex Horton, who was our assistant principal bassist, was my successor in Alabama. So he, as principal. So after I left, he won my former position. And obviously, you know him. And he played for 6 seasons with you guys, I think. And eventually started advancing in other auditions, or started making finals in other auditions, and then got the Chicago job. So he kind of did the thing that I decided I didn't want to try to do or was unable to do. So I don't know if he flew around and took lessons, but like, yeah, you could look at it and say, hey, you've got a steady paycheck, and like Birmingham, like it's a very livable paycheck. At least when I was there, it was. And so like you could afford a plane ticket like once a month, once every couple months. But there's something about the week to week progress, of being in school and setting just that regular exposure to a teacher. And oh my gosh, the masterclasses, like weekly masterclasses with bass players who are just as good as you, the competitive atmosphere of like being around not just great bass players, but great violinists and wind players and everything. Like everybody's taking auditions, trying to like, it's just like, there's a culture of, I don't know, I almost want to say scarcity, like everybody's hungry. Mm. And so, but yeah, also just the weekly accountability of weekly lessons. I mean, if I were just a more, like, if I were in Alabama, like I could have made it work if I were maybe just a more motivated person of like, I'm going to commit to one lesson a month, and I'm going to commit to like just work really hard on planning out my long-term development. But that's not where I was at in my life at that point. And so like the weekly accountability with being in school was just a really good fit for me.
Sure. That makes sense. Yeah. So you finish USC, and then was this, I mean, I know there's a period of time where you were regularly making like finals or super finals of some big auditions, but nothing had, you hadn't closed anything out at that point. Was this around that same time, or was it later? Help, like basically when you left USC, what did your life look like at that point, and what happened after that?
Yeah, it was pretty crazy because I did so I won the lyric audition in my first year of my master's, and then I decided not to take it. So I finished my master's at USC, and I'd still not gotten anything. And so I decided to stay at USC for a graduate certificate, which is just like those degrees at every music school where it's basically just lessons and orchestra and master classes. So that's another 2-year program. So I did my first year of a GC, and after my first year of a GC, so this is my third year at USC. That's when I had like a pretty strong spring of like, let's see, super semis in Minnesota, finals in Seattle, and super finals in St. Louis. That was like, I had some pretty consistent success in like that spring. And nothing worked out. And so I went to Tanglewood that summer, which was so amazing.
Yeah.
And I know you've been there.
Man, yeah. I love Tanglewood.
I would go back to Tanglewood now. It was so awesome. And then I came back in the fall and took Detroit and I didn't get out of semis. And that was really disappointing because it's like, you know how it is, like when you have a string of successes, people are telling you, oh, it's just a matter of time. And like, all you got to do is keep doing what you're doing. And then I didn't advance, and I was like, oh, well, maybe it was just lucky, or maybe I just, it was a fluke or something. And just,
he starts to like doubt it a little bit.
Yeah. Like all this stuff about the narrative you write about your story. But actually the thing that like, I think you'll find really interesting. And I remember this is like when you and I started really talking more about audition preparation, because like still, even when I made like, super finals in St. Louis and like all the stuff that spring, I still didn't really practice music slow. Like I kind of just like ran stuff over and over again. And until like, it just sounded presentable, even though I felt uncomfortable and it was like kind of not the most consistent. Like I got it. I was at it in my mind. It feels like I was like putting lipstick on a pig, you know, sure. Like something that was like really kind of not a healthy way of playing and making music, but I was like making it sound like presentable. But I had this deep feeling of like, there's something really uncomfortable and wrong with the way I'm preparing. It doesn't feel controlled. It doesn't feel like consistent. And I remember talking to you on the phone, also talking to Brendan Fitzgerald, and well, I know you've interviewed before, and just like a handful of people who I felt like were leveling up their consistency and also like the organization of the way you would prepare music. Like the quote, your quote that you've used before, like the difference between amateurs and professionals is amateurs practice till they get it right, whereas professionals practice until they can't get it wrong.
Sure.
And I never felt like I was at the point where it was always practicing until it finally was right, rather than practicing until I only play it right.
Right. You know? Right. Right.
And so that kind of, the fact that I went from having a really good spring to coming back after Tanglewood and not doing well in Detroit, I was kind of like, that shouldn't happen. Like there should be more consistency in what I'm doing. And so I started talking to you about programs, powerlifting, reps, like all that stuff. And that is probably the biggest shift in my musicianship in my life.
It's so interesting because Brendan, I think he kind of shifted his audition prep, because it was like 4 or 5 years ago, I was live streaming me preparing a piece. It was like the first time I was really, it wasn't nearly as structured as it is now, but I was just experimenting with the idea of like being somewhat programmatic about my practice. And yeah, he sort of took that and made it his own. And from what I've heard, a couple of people, bass players, have like sort of adopted that or a variation of that. I think Alex Horton adopted some version of that or of that style. And it's so interesting to hear because like I've experienced the same exact thing. Like I'm working up an audition list like right now, and I've done it enough times now that like the beginning of the process, like I've missed this note or this is out of tune or this is that. And I don't even freak out anymore. I'm like, I'll just fix that. And then I'll get better. And then I'll find the solution. And then I'll do it so that I'll do it always correctly or close to that. Obviously it's not going to be 100% perfect, but it's really cool to me that sort of the high and then the coming back down for Detroit is the thing that motivated you to say, this shouldn't happen. I got to figure this out, because you would imagine you're just so much better off now. I'm sure you would agree now, having had that experience of coming back down after Detroit and then deciding to dive into that, you would say you're a more consistent musician just in general for like diving into those types of things. And it's funny because you wouldn't have probably designed it that way, right? You wouldn't have been like, oh, like I'll have a couple of good auditions and then I'm going to have one bad one and that's going to motivate me. Or not even bad. You just didn't get out of the semis and that's going to motivate me. But obviously those, I guess I'm, what my point of all of this is to say, like we have these things in our life that happen that aren't great or they're not what we want, but often those things motivate us to make some sort of change that is ultimately better for us. And it could apply to anything. And it's cool. It's cool to hear that in your story here, I guess, at this point.
Yeah, totally. I mean, like the time, you're right. It's like, you're just always kind of, life is always like presenting you with challenges and it's always an opportunity for growth. But I remember having, I just remember having conversations with you on the phone or with like Kyle Sanborn. Do you know Kyle?
I do. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, yeah, he's played with Alabama a couple times, I guess. And like, so I was sending Kyle mock auditions, like videos, and he was observing issues with like cleanliness or intonation or something. And we would just somehow through the course of our comments, we would get back to like me basically saying like, yeah, I just don't really practice slow. Mm. And we had like three or four of those conversations. And eventually I was just like, I can't just, clearly we keep coming back to this. Like why, like I, if I can't do it fast, why am I trying to do it fast? And basically I was avoiding it. Like I was like, it's going to require, again, taking a risk, like to invent a new way of practicing that I think, you know, it's like when you're making finals, I think I was just in kind of a tough place where like I was able to make finals sometimes with the skill set that I had, mm-hmm. but not reliably enough. And so I was kind of like, okay, I either keep doing what I'm doing and maybe I'll be okay, or I follow my gut feeling, my really strong gut feeling that like I'm not as consistent and don't have a level of mastery over this that I know I want to have. And it might set me back for an audition or two, but eventually it will probably be the healthy move. And eventually I just had to decide to, what do they say? Like your choice is either to stay the same or change.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's kind of what it was like.
I mean, I remember
the same wasn't working.
I remember that conversation, one of at least one of them, but one in particular where you were talking to me and I was kind of sharing with you some ideas. And yeah, I could I can totally empathize with that where you're like, well, what if I just keep doing what I'm doing and I hit the jackpot? You know, like what if the audition that I like try something new on is the audition I would have won if I just would have done what I normally did? And it's yeah, like, exactly. I can totally understand that. Yeah, that's, I just feel like a lot of people can be, you just, it's like I was in that position, but I like had a job. And then especially COVID was basically like, well, there's nothing going on. I can just sort of reset a little bit. You were doing it like with your career, you know, like right. your career, like well, trajectory.
Yeah. And it's like, I think the thing is, I think people view like risky decisions as only worth it if they pay off. Like only worth it if they succeed, if they get the outcome they want. But if you view a risky decision as just an opportunity to learn something, then it's like, you can't, I hate to put it in such simplistic terms, but it's like, then you can't lose. Like I could experiment with a new practice method and then just totally blow it and be like, I thought that felt right. And it turns out it really was wrong. And now I won't do that again. And that's like still, it was still the right call. Same thing with me leaving Alabama. Like maybe I would really regret that decision and then learn something from it and say, okay, like I, turns out I really do want a stable orchestra job, even if it's not like the Chicago Symphony, you know? And, yeah. But you just always, but it's kind of like, I that's just not a way, that's been a big area of growth for me has been not letting like fear keep me from doing things that I know I would learn from. Like if people say like, I don't know if I'm going to win, so it's better that I just don't do it at all. Like that's not really, it's just so limiting, you know?
Yeah. That's, I love that perspective. So you finished that time at USC. So you're a GC. Yeah. And then what happens?
So, yeah, the crazy thing that happened is just the pandemic. Like I did the first year of the GC and I had that good spring. Then I did an advance in Detroit. And then I was like, just starting to really retool my practice and I went into lessons saying, okay, I'm going to perform Beethoven 5 at 70% tempo. And I'm going to perform Mozart 35 at 50% tempo. I remember David said to me, like, you need to know that it's okay to come into lessons with music under tempo. I finally did that in my third year of my master's. It took me that long to start to just like focus on being constructive rather than on just performing all the time. And then the pandemic happened. So I deferred. I took a leave of absence from school because I didn't want to like waste my school doing Zoom lessons. And so I moved back to Chicago. I drove back to Chicago and lived with my parents for 9 months and prepared mock auditions in their basement and just went through like the real meat and potatoes of this like slow practice stuff. Like I did that in my parents' basement during the pandemic and was sending videos. I like just one thing I did, like, so I told you I had made the super semis in Minnesota. And so I contacted the principal there, Kristen Bruya. And I asked her, like, this is in the pandemic when nobody was doing anything. And I'm not sure exactly what they were up to, but I said, like, if I prepared the Minnesota list just for myself, could I send it to you? And would you be willing to give me feedback? And she said, yes.
Wow.
And so I just worked up the list and I think that was maybe the first one or second one where I came up with like a real program. And this was, I had moved out of my parents and moved in with my brother at this point in Chicago. But so I prepared that list and sent it to her and got really good feedback. And I sent it to another section player there. And so, yeah, basically I was doing mock auditions. My plan was to just, I didn't know what was going to happen to orchestras, but I was like, the best thing that I can do is to just keep working on my audition preparation. So when auditions come back, like I'll be ready. And so that's what I did, until I broke my collarbone, which I told you about that, right?
Yeah. Until I broke my collarbone,
which was like, that was crazy.
Yeah,
I was mountain biking with my parents and, I just like went over a cliff, like, a, or not a cliff. Like I went over this, like a hill with like a pretty steep drop off and I lost my balance and just tumbled off the cliff and just landed on my shoulder and broke my collarbone. And it's just like the most painful thing that's ever happened to me.
So how long did that knock you out for again?
3 months. I couldn't really prepare music for 3 months. I was fortunate to have a brace that basically was like backpack straps that go over your shoulder and pull them back so that your bone will be like set in the right position. So I was able to move, like I had my range of motion. So I could basically play open strings and that's it. Mm. So I never stopped moving and didn't completely stop playing, which is really good, I think, but mm-hmm. I couldn't actually play music like with any seriousness for 3 months.
Wow.
So yeah, that was pretty crazy. It was like, when I look back on it, it's like, okay, the pandemic happened. So their orchestras aren't playing and auditions aren't happening, but at least I can prepare mock auditions. And then I broke my collarbone, so I couldn't even do that. So yeah. It's like just everything about my career goals was just like press pause, you know?
Wow. So I don't, it's just, yeah. Like the way you just sort of summed that up. I mean, it would be devastating, I imagine. Yeah. I know that you were New World. So can you walk us from the time that you were healed from your collarbone to that? Cause it's like, or you can skip right ahead and just say you won New World and talk about that. But it's funny because generally speaking, for most people, the order of operations is school, New World, and then like a full-time professional performing job. That's like the general thing. But you did school, job, school, school, New World, job. And yeah, so walk us through what made you audition for New World and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Like after I healed from, after my collarbone got better, I went back to USC to finish my last year of my grad certificate. So I did that. And then, my collarbone healed. And shortly after that is when I auditioned for New World. I submitted a video audition. Cause they were doing Zoom auditions. So I submitted a video audition in like the spring, and I found out that I think I was on the wait list or something. And so I went back to school, to finish my last year of my GC. And then in the fall, like just after I had started at USC, they let me know that I had gotten off the wait list and I was invited to come to New World.
Oh, cool.
So I did my first semester with David and then I left for New World in January. And it was kind of one of those things where I felt like I had done 3.5 years with David. And that was enough time. Like I'm ready to leave school and just go out and be my own teacher from here on. I moved from LA to Miami and got there in January and was there for, I started in January and then the Chicago audition was in April. So I took that audition and, I came up and did a trial with the orchestra and I passed my trial in June. So I was in New World for about 4 months, I think.
Yeah. And I would love to, you know, maybe on a different podcast, you know, talk about the audition process for Chicago and just talking about what that was like for you. Cause I'm certainly curious. We don't have to do it right now though, cause it's sort of outside of the scope of this, but you know, now we've gotten from when you and I lived together and we're sitting outside in a chair yelling at cars with a megaphone you're in the Chicago Symphony, you know, and just like reflecting back, are there any sort of final, I don't want to say final takeaways, but it's that kind of idea. What kind of takeaways do you have or what kinds of thoughts do you have to share just about like your story and how it happened? And just for anyone listening that you might be able to speak to in some way.
Yeah. Man, I don't know. It's like, I know I'm not a religious person. I know you are. And one of the things you've said a handful of times is that like, you feel like there's a plan for you. And I think like looking back, it's kind of like every bump in the road has felt like a part of who I've become. And, it was to teach me something. And I think especially young musicians and students, they look at their lives as like, this is supposed to happen in a certain order and this is supposed to be on a certain timeline kind of. And the hardest thing for me has just been like letting go of that sense of comparing myself to other people and that there's a certain way my life is supposed to go, and like just making the decision that feels good to me where I am in my life at the time. And like, I'm still not there yet. Like, I'm still working on that. Just like not judging myself for the way my life is and just trying to accept where I'm at and then do my best with the cards I have. But it's been really liberating to like, to just embrace your own path. That's something my mom, to my mom's credit, all through my journey, she's always said over and over again, like a broken record, like you are on your own trajectory. And that's been really, really helpful for me. And I wish more people, I wish that if I would like the classical music industry and students to view their lives more that way. I think we would be a much healthier industry if people were more supportive towards themselves in that way, you know?
Yeah, man. Well, I'm grateful for this. So I've, like, as you know, I've been wanting to do this for such a long time. I feel like I've been asking you at least like for like 2 years, like, can we do this? And you're like, well, let's wait for this thing. Let's wait for this thing. So it's very cool for me that the moment is here. And I just want to thank you again for going there with me and telling this story. It's so cool to connect with you in this way. So I appreciate it, man.
Dude, it's the pleasure is all mine. I just love your podcast, and like watching what you've been up to since I left Alabama has been like, honestly, just a real inspiration for me. Watching your growth, like you and I have both grown a lot and developed, and I think you are an amazing resource for the musical community, and it's just, I'm honored to be part of your podcast.
I appreciate that, man. Couple other thank yous. I want to thank Brandon Yoakum for his work on mastering this episode. Brandon is the mastering engineer for the podcast. Yes. You can find Brandon at epiphanyrecordingstudio.com. And I just want to thank you for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it, and we will see you in the next one.